Have you ever felt that pang of disappointment when you couldn't add a ticket to your collection because it was digital? Or maybe you just lost it? Well, StubForge.com is here to change that. Imagine this: tickets that not only look but feel like the real deal. Because each ticket from StubForge is printed on the same quality stock that Ticketmaster uses and printed with genuine ticket printers. It's like holding a piece of the concert, the game, or the show right in your hands. But StubForge isn't just about replacing tickets. With the easy-to-use interactive designer, you can create custom tickets for anything, from concerts to sports games, pregnancy announcements, or parties. Why not make your invitations stand out with tickets that are as unique as your event? And if you're trying to complete a back catalogue of missing tickets, StubForge offers bulk discounts to make it both easy and affordable. With StubForge, you can once more give your loved ones physical tickets and see their eyes light up instantly at the best gift you can give. So whether you're looking to reignite your ticket collection, craft the perfect gift, or send the coolest invites, head over to StubForge.com. Start creating today and see how StubForge makes every ticket a story worth saving. Visit StubForge.com and start making tickets today.
My next guest in the Bravery Academy is Dr. Carolyn Ainslie. At a young age, Carolyn was forced to live at Centrepoint, one of New Zealand's most famous cults in the 1980s and 1990s. In today's episode, she shares her experience, her road to recovery, and part of that is finding her voice after so many years of feeling silenced. It is with courage, connection, and compassion she still continues her work as a GP today and helping others learn from her life experience. Welcome, Dr. Carolyn, to the Bravery Academy. I am really excited to have you today on the podcast for several reasons. Both your background as a doctor, and I know we're going to talk about that today around how we can help others heal through trauma, but also your story of bravery and resilience and how you are doing what you are doing today. So first of all, welcome.
Kia ora.
Can you tell me, where do you live and where you're from?
Where I live currently, I live in Otatahi, Christchurch, in the middle of the South Island of New Zealand, for your international listeners. Oh, I've been living here for about the last 12 years, though I also lived here in my adolescence and I did my first degree at Canterbury University. Yeah, but I grew up as a child in Auckland.
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons why we're talking today, right? This big story that you have been so brave to share. And I think there's going to be two elements to today's interview. The first bit is people that don't know your story. There's a great podcast that you have been working on, and we'll talk about that as we go through today's episode that can help people understand what you've been through. But for those that don't know about Centrepoint and the experience, can you talk a little briefly around what you went through in your childhood?
Well, yeah. Okay. What I'd say is I grew up in Albany, which is in the North Shore of Auckland. When I was a kid in the 1970s, it was, and in the 80s, it was a rural part of Auckland. We had paddocks next door. We had a pond and horses across the road. It was a gravel road. No one drove down it. And up the road, when I was about three, a community moved in called Centrepoint. Just about 3 kilometres up the road. All the kids from that community, and at that stage, there weren't many, but it grew over about 3 or 4 years to being a large number of children went to our local primary school, which was Albany Primary School, a really small school at that point, but then suddenly not so small with all these extra kids joining over a few years. And my family were pretty connected to the Albany community. And when this pretty out there group of, I don't know how you describe them, hippies, I guess, moved into the area, they were, it was really controversial for the neighbourhood. It started before it became a physical community. It started with a group of professional people who gathered around Bert Potter, who was a self-proclaimed therapist at the time. He didn't really have a lot of expertise, but he developed some expertise through travel. He went to a place called Esalen in California and learned about the human potential movement. He went to Pune in India and learnt from Rajneesh, the Bhagwan, about how to be a guru. And when they were operating as the Shoreline Trust in the North Shore, before they actually moved onto the Centrepoint property, they were doing workshops based very much on the human potential movement. And they were therapeutic in intent, and they were attracting a following in the health and wellness, mental health space in Auckland. And they had a reputation for making a difference in people's lives. So, yeah, they were well received, but they really shook things up. They were controversial. And when they moved into Albany in 1977, 78, the way they lived was really controversial. Clothing was optional. They shared everything. They practiced free sexuality, free, open, unrestrained, regular, noisy sexuality. They didn't hide their children from this. They broke down all the boundaries in their living arrangements. And that was intentional to help people let go of their egos, but also it was an intentional move to discombobulate and put people on edge. It was all part of development of a cult.
A cult.
I'm talking about that. But at the time, I don't think that was what was going on. That's just my take on it now, 30 years later. But it was really controversial. The Albany community struggled. Some people really were like, oh, great, shake things up. You know, it's time to let go of the repressive thinking of the 60s and the 50s and you know, like monogamy. Is that important? You know, I don't know. Let's try this. You know, there were a lot of free, open, radical people, and my father was one of them. And we had a close association with the Centrepoint community because of my father's involvement with the local school. And my friendship with one of the kids of the community. So time rolled on a little bit, and then our family goes through a massive upheaval, huge. There's domestic violence, there's severe psychiatric illness, there's uplifting of children. It was a very, very unsafe place for children during that time. We had involvement of social workers and all sorts. And the question of who would look after me came up, and a decision was made for me to move in with my best friend, who was now living full-time at Centrepoint with her mum. So that I was 7 at the time. Input from family while I was there was minimal. The time I was there, it was months, and there was probably multiple times I was there over a year or two, but the time I recall was the big chunk of months. So I'm not a typical Centrepoint kid, and in fact, I really reluctantly call myself a Centrepoint child because I wasn't part of a family unit that was bought in, sold in membership. But I experienced some of the good and most of the worst of being there. And I don't think I was a unique child. I think there were other kids like me who came and went in an unprotected way. So our family situation resolved eventually, and I returned to our family home, which by then was a real skeleton of its former home, and life went on. I was never asked about it.
So it was never talked about?
Never talked about, no. And I think, you know, bearing in mind we were a large family and every single of us experienced a trauma of some variety. So mine was just one of many. I guess I'm trying to paint the context of the silence. And the thing that probably was unique about my experience, which is why the silence galls so terribly, is that the whole of New Zealand woke up to what happened to Centrepoint through the 80s and 90s. Centrepoint was extraordinarily controversial in Auckland. They went through a period where they were homeless effectively for about 18 months, I think, when they were having issues with the Takapuna District Council because they were exceeding their number of people allowed on the property, which was all over the news all the time. And there's also whistleblowers coming out. And then there was just the simple fact of the controversy and the fact that Bert Potter was a shameless, shameless advocate of the, inverted commas for your listeners, sexual liberation of children. Absolutely shameless. And he was not the only one talking about the sexual liberation of children. Around the same time, the leader of the Children of God, I've forgotten his name, started in America. He was also talking about the sexual liberation of children. And I believe there was something about that from the Rajneesh cult as well, but don't quote me on that. Definitely, yeah. Definitely the Children of God, which was a slightly earlier cult, and I'm absolutely certain that international cult, Bert Potter would have been paying close attention to what was coming out of there because it was as extreme as Centre Point in terms of how children were treated and the early sexualisation of children. There was no hiding in those early years. And I know people who were children who moved into Centre Point, and right from the get-go, kids were being pressured, pushed, encouraged into early sexual contact with adults under the guise that they should be expressing themselves. It's natural, any adult contact, as long as there's consent and an extremely problematic understanding what that actually means, i.e. they don't say no.
I don't know how to say no.
Yeah. It's very, very problematic. That was happening from early on. And then as the first whistleblowers started to come out around the time I was there, I think, which was 1983, the first sort of newspaper headings, sort of sex kiddie cult kind of headings in the local rag. And there was also a documentary, a really famous one that you can actually watch if you go digging on the New Zealand archives, I think. In 1980, it was a bit of propaganda about how wonderful it was to live at Centre Point. It was everywhere, Centre Point. You know, like, that was not a quiet, under the cover, in the background community.
There's some really big moments in there that I'm hearing from you. And the first was that as a child, you weren't protected. And so many of the children in that space. So who was supposed to be protecting those kids at that time?
Well, part of the philosophy of Centre Point, of Bert, was that, you know, we all look after all of the children. Like I was talking earlier about boundaries being broken down. And one of the boundaries, the natural boundaries, was the parent-child relationship and the sacredness of that. And that was, I think, in my opinion, deliberately broken down to separate. I think in many ways because children were annoying. You know, children get in the way of your devotion to the guru, to the master. Like, you have an allegiance to your child, a natural, deep, biological allegiance to your child. And that is pretty annoying if you're a guru and you're actually requiring and demanding total subservience to you and for your needs and your agenda to be the first and foremost for all of your members. So you want to break that down as much as possible. So kids would sleep separately. You'd hardly ever see them. The day-to-day of life in the community, the getting up, getting dressed, brushing your teeth, toileting, showering, feeding, finding your lunch, off to school, all that stuff that is a tedious part of my parenting.
Yeah. And mine.
Yeah. Did not exist in the parental-child relationship at Centre Point. You could not see your parents for days. Someone once told me that they ran away when they were 10 and they came back and they'd been away for like 3 days. No one had noticed they were gone. You know, like, so that the neglect was massive. You know, one thing that Centre Point kids always talk about and comes up repeatedly from a medical perspective is the poor dentition that the kids have. And I've heard this again talked about by kids in other groups, you know, that the basic preventative care that, you know, that means that if you brush your teeth every day, you don't end up with awful teeth in your adulthood. It wasn't happening. So lots of neglect. Parents were all busy elsewhere. They were attending to their personal therapeutic needs. They were in their work groups. They were seeing their personal therapists because this was a therapy cult, right? It was all based on personal development, personal change, personal healing, which, you know, you and I recognize the value of that because we're health professionals. Yeah. The whole point of this is about understanding our hurts and growing and changing and becoming better versions of ourselves. But this is not how it was used there. You know, the therapy, the confessions to your therapist, all of that was used as a way to abuse and control people. way of gathering information, oppressing, squashing, distracting.
To share that story, and I know you've shared it several times, both in the new podcast, the Cult Chat that you're doing now.
Yeah. Yeah.
But actually to get to this point of sharing it has, when we talked before coming onto this podcast, it's one of the reasons why I wanted you on here today. It's not necessarily what you went through at the time, even though that was challenging and awful. It's actually been the bravery to speak up and your drive to share the story. Can you tell me what was the driving points to get you there after 30 years of silence?
I knew as a kid I was silent because I simply could not speak about what happened, even though Centrepoint was all over the news, even though people I loved, who I was a child with at Centrepoint, were on documentaries talking about trauma, awful, awful trauma in like the 80s and 90s. Still no one was coming to me and talking to me about what happened. So I guess what I'm trying to say is I learnt when no one asks you about an awful thing that everyone knows about, you drew a few conclusions. One is, well, maybe I'm crazy and it never happened. If everyone knows about this thing, it's really obvious that it happened and no one mentions anything to me. Maybe I'm crazy it never happened. Or maybe it did happen, but it just didn't matter. You know, or maybe they didn't know. I think for many of my siblings, they didn't know. I mean, that's the effect of a culture of silence, is that actually people don't know because, you know, not everyone has the ability to notice. So, you know, I did tell some people in my adolescence, and they weren't the people I should have been telling. They weren't my parents. And I had mixed responses. One person was an incredibly safe place, and that was really important to me. So I got the most hard reveal off my chest. And then as, you know, I matured through my teens and into my 20s, I had touch points where it came up. And sometimes that was prompted by the media, other times because Centrepoint had been in the news again for someone going to jail or some revelation coming up. Or it would be a personal crisis, like a breakup with a boyfriend. Why did I behave like that? Gosh, I don't want that to happen again. You know, something like that. So I'd see a therapist or I'd unpack what I could and then it would dissipate. And I think the important thing was when you don't talk about something, particularly something that happened to you as a child, particularly something so weird, so foreign, so shaming, you don't have language in your own head for unpacking it. You don't recognize in any way that it's weird or abnormal or wrong, not only the experience, but the response to the experience. So you're just in your own little microcosm, your own little head that believes the BS, that believes what happened to you doesn't matter, it was probably your fault, get over it, you know, those sorts of conclusions. So, you know, fast forward. I think what really did me in was parenting. I don't know if it was a coincidence or not, because it was a really big coincidence, but in the year that my first child, my son, was 7, that was the year that I was really triggered. I was triggered repeatedly every day just through really innocent things that he would say and do that brought in my mind over and over again the innocence of a 7-year-old. Because I was 7 when I was at Centrepoint. I was 7 and I was alone and I was abandoned and I was lost and I was terrified. And so, you know, when he would, I don't know, fall over, hurt his knee and cry and I'd go to him, or when he would ask an innocent question, or when he would be afraid at night, or when I'd send him off to school, honestly, really innocent interactions. I had this, it was really awful. At times, my 7-year-old self would pose herself on him physically, like as an image, as a vision, as a ghost. And I had 2 7-year-olds in my house with me. Yeah. And the way I think of that year was like these 2 little children were dancing in front of me, or they were almost fighting in front of me for my attention. One was alive and real and deserved to be protected and loved and cared for. The other one was gone and never knew those things.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I had this fight within me to kind of go, hey, he deserves better than this.
Yeah.
He deserves better than this, but she also deserves better than this. And I had to find a way to pull them apart, because that's the problem when we don't face our history, is that our children end up triggering us into a past we have not faced. And if there's no better reason, that is it. That is the best reason to do your work. So the coincidence I was talking about was coincidentally in that year that he was 7 and I was getting triggered up the yin yang, published an article in the North and South at the end of that year. Basically, the question was, you know, Centrepoint closed in 2000, it's now 2015. What about the children? And so that article in the North and South, I happened to read it while I was at work one day. And again, boom, you know, like that totally toppled me. Hearing the stories of some other, mostly women, there was the odd guy who shared a story in there, but mostly women, about what it was like to be a child at Centrepoint. I never heard another single, other than a documentary I'd seen, which a child of the community had talked about her experiences. I hadn't heard any stories about children from Centrepoint. And that, I think, I guess, that probably comes back to why I think there's so much power in podcasts, in documentaries, in survivor stories. Because for me, it was survivor stories that shook me out, that drew me out of my silence. Because they said to me, you are not alone. You know, all the gaslighting, whether deliberate or actually spoken to me by my parents, basically, that either actually spoken or implicitly through failure to engage on the topic, you know, either inactive or active silencing, told me that it didn't matter. And so to hear other people go, no, it really did. And this is how awful it was. You know, like, so many of the stories in there, I'd never heard anyone else say specific instances that I experienced. I wasn't even sure if they were real. And that just ignited something in me.
Hi there. I'm Heather Drago.
And I'm Sarah Saunders.
We host the podcast, That's a Hard No, about saying no and setting boundaries.
So you can become that true and empowered you that this world needs. Saying no isn't just okay.
It's the key to living an authentic, fulfilling life.
I'm a licensed professional clinical counselor, so while this podcast is in no way a replacement for one-on-one therapy, I suppose I know what I'm talking about.
I'd say so. We talk about learning to say no and set healthy boundaries and how it impacts mental health, physical health, relationships, parenthood, and more.
Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and visit our website, hardnopodcast.com.
We're here to help you find your no and say it unapologetically.
That's a hard no.
Our lives were never the same after we learned our 21-year-old daughter, Kristen, was murdered by her ex-boyfriend. It's a parent's worst nightmare. How much did we really know about domestic violence back then? Clearly not enough. Now we know plenty. We know domestic violence, or DV, can happen to anyone. 1 in 3 women suffer physical violence at the hands of intimate partners during their lifetimes. 1 in 3. I'm Bill Mitchell, host of the When Dating Hurts podcast. And my interviews with DV counselors, law enforcement, and especially actual DV survivors give the pandemic of domestic violence the attention it deserves. The When Dating Hurts podcast. It's a series of lives being saved.
As you start to share that story, it becomes a bit of exposure therapy in some ways, because to go from what you've done now to even speaking here so eloquently around what happened to you, which has given me goosebumps as you've been speaking, it's taken a lot to get to that, you know, when your son was 7, to be here now, to bravely share the story.
Yeah, well, what I didn't mention was that each time I was triggered, I'd go into a tailspin.
Yeah.
And that's grotesquely unpleasant for anyone, let alone a person who's accustomed to operating at a really high function. Yeah. You know, as I said, when I was a GP,
yeah,
working clinically, dealing with people, I was the mature, professional, together person. And I could be flipping all over the place and going under, you know, not in my world, thank you very much. And, you know, this had happened so many times over the course of so many years, unexpected, out of my control, triggering that, yeah, it usually only lasted a few weeks.
It's still a long time, though.
It is a long time. And that was a survival technique. I learned that what I feel, how I'm feeling doesn't matter. So disconnect from it, move away from it, and it'll go away, which is fine if you can't get out of the place of trauma, but it's not so great as an adult.
Right.
Like, there's so many things we learn in traumatic moments, particularly as children, that served us then, but they do not serve us now. They actually cause deep dysfunction in our lives. And I was really sick of that dysfunction. And I think I was probably also at a place in life where deep, deep down, I knew I could do it now. I was in a stable marriage, surrounded by old, deep, wide friendships. Many of my family relationships that I was terrified of losing if I ever spoke about what happened to me, I felt that I could start to strategically bring what happened to me to those relationships and it could still be okay. So yes, you talked about exposure therapy. So what I did was exposure therapy. I did little things. I remember, you know, deciding to send the journalist who wrote that article in the North and South, her name's Anka, an email. I remember my finger hovering over the send button for like 20 minutes, like an incredibly long time, you know, like going and knowing that this was going to start a cascade of events. I could back out of it at any point, but my integrity would not allow me to, you know, like if I was going to live as the person I believed I was, live within my values, then I was no longer going to live in fear. And the thing about fear is that, and that's what anxiety is, you know, the thing about fear is it's overblown in our heads. We think it's far, far bigger than it is. And sometimes what we really need to be brave is to take little steps. You know, what is the next step? The next step in that moment was just hit return. You know, and everything in me said, don't hit return.
Mm.
You're about to send an email to a journalist about what happened to you. Just do it. Okay. And away it went. Whoosh. So, oh, fuck.
Ask you how your mind and your body responded over that time.
Oh, I was so anxious.
Yeah.
I was so anxious thinking, oh, people in the school gates, they'll come out and it's like I'll be wearing no clothes.
Yeah.
You know, and they will know that I'm one of those kids, you know. It was terrifying. Anyway, wasn't that big a deal really at all. You know, it was hard, but I got myself all ready for this big thing and not that big a deal actually. It kind of feels a bit disappointing,
yeah.
Which of course is setting me up for what came next. I knew there was a documentary being developed. And as I got bolder, you know, I knew I had to put my name to it. And so I eventually did start to put my name to it. So anyway, the documentary started to develop. This is the Heaven and Hell Centrepoint story commissioned by TVNZ that came out in 2020. And I got approached and I knew I would because no one else was talking about it. So I kind of knew it was coming. And it took me a long time, actually, once I met the producer, to decide to air my story. I mean, I had massive imposter syndrome. It's like, who am I? Who am I? I am no one. And, of course, that was the message that everyone was shouting to me loud and clear. Any of the adults I met from the community, many of the children, not all of them, not all of them, but many of the children were like, who is she?
Yeah.
She's not a real kid of the community. How is she? She can't speak for us. And I was like, well, I'm not speaking for you. I'm speaking for me.
Yeah. So you had a lot of pushback over even that time when you were being brave to share.
Yeah, I did. it was 2018, 2019, I first heard about adverse childhood experiences in a talk given here in Canterbury by one of the big educators of GPs. And I was sitting in a room with a whole bunch of other GPs. No one had ever heard of this before. And now that I think about it, I'm like a bit shocked about that.
Isn't that exactly? That's horrifying. That yeah. is literally one of the defining things that impacts our health long term. In 2018, we begin to uncover it. Yeah, I was similar time.
And the study, the original study was, I think, in the 1980s, 1990s, 80s. The study was in the 80s and it first came out in the 1990s. So the ACE study was looking at a whole bunch of kids and kind of looking at correlating their personal histories with their medical consequences. And there's a bunch of ones that have come further. So ACE means adverse childhood experience. It's looking forward to kind of go, well, you know, if you are riddled with cancer, you've got ischemic heart disease, you're anxious, you've got gout, what's your childhood like? So I was sitting in that talk and they were running through the actual ACEs. There's 10 of them. And I was doing my own ACE score. Emotional abuse, physical abuse, sexual abuse, physical neglect, emotional neglect, substance abuse in the household, mental illness in the household, mother treated violently, divorce or parental separation, criminal behavior in the household. And I worked it out and I was like, so the highest score is 10. And I worked it out and I was like, I've got 6. And so the ACE study strongly establishes a dose response relationship. A person with an ACE score of 7 or more has triple the lifetime odds of getting lung cancer. And 3.5 times the odds of having ischemic heart disease. And I'm reading from The Deepest Well by Dr. Nadine Burke-Harris, who goes into all of the medical consequences of having adverse ACEs. And so that was pretty shocking to me personally, to kind of go, my childhood means that I'm more likely to have shorter life. That's pretty shocking. And it's also shocking to realize, do I know those details about my patients? So I asked, do I correlate? And that leads into the whole idea of trauma-informed care. And I first heard about trauma-informed care when a colleague of mine, who is pretty well known across New Zealand as a GP with an expertise in assault and abuse, she brought it to my attention, because one of my jobs is a website that provides point of care information to GPs in Canterbury. And I've got a sort of a fairly significant leadership role across New Zealand in that space. So she came to me and she said, we don't have anything on Health Path here in Canterbury, which is the website that I manage for doctors in Christchurch. And that was 2021 that it went live. So she probably spent 2020 writing it. And I hadn't really heard of it at that point. That's made me excruciatingly conscious of the question, what happened to you? What happens to you? Chronic pain, chronic pelvic pain, depression, anxiety, chronic fatigue, unexplained neurological symptoms, borderline personality disorder, self-harm, suicide, addiction, irritable bowel, chronic daily headache, all conditions that we don't have great treatments for medically. And many, many times there's abuse at the heart of it. Trauma, you know, not necessarily abuse. It's also an equity issue, because actually one of the things that traumatizes people is oppression, cultural alienation, racism, discrimination, you know, like that is over a lifetime. And trauma-informed care is particularly relevant if you want to provide equitable care, you know, because so many more Pacifica LGBTQ people have experienced a much higher proportion of trauma as a result of their othering.
The more that we stop and listen and be present for somebody, whether it's in our workplace, whether it's in our relationships, whether it's our children, it actually is enough, and that makes a difference in this human connection.
Yeah, well, you're reminding me of another book by Bruce Perry. Yeah, just grab it off my bookshelf. The Boy Who's Raised as a Dog. And I remember reading that. I hadn't read that in a long time. It's got some truly terrible, triggering case studies in it of some of the psychiatrists' cases of children. But what he keeps on coming back to, and he doesn't explicitly say it, I don't know, but what it comes through very strongly is the power of a witness, of a benevolent witness in the life of a child. someone who stands by and says, you are loved, you are doing well, you are safe with me. And for me, that was my teacher, Mrs. Carter. I felt safe on the mat at her feet as she read The Hobbit. And I would pat her dog. She used to bring a dog into school every day. And she taught me through the years that I was going through the biggest heartache, the two concurrent years when I was 7 and 8. She taught me, even though she was a bit scary, that I was safe and I was loved. And that might not seem like much, really. It's just a school teacher. But boy, I have thought of her over and over and over and over again in my adult life.
So, Kaz, can you tell me about the podcast that you've been working on, which is now part of this next mission of sharing stories?
Yeah. I wasn't happy with just going on a documentary because I only got 9 minutes of the whole thing. No way was enough. And I had way more things to say after that documentary. So I decided, because, you know, so much of being involved with the Centrepoint story really hurt me. And I decided, actually, not everyone cared about what I cared about. And I needed to find some allies who deeply cared about the landscape in New Zealand. You know, what happened to Centrepoint happened. Lots of people went to jail. Lots and lots of children got harmed. And nothing changed, you know, nothing changed. So that Gloria Vale, which is doing exactly the same thing to a whole bunch of vulnerable children right now in New Zealand, is still possible. Government inaction, agency ignorance, tolerance from society has just allowed it. And I guess I have the ability to tie that together. And so I sought out a couple of women who also care enormously about this topic. Liz Gregory, who is the founder of the Gloria Vale Leavers Support Trust. She founded it 10 years ago once she saw all these people coming out of Gloria Vale and there was nothing for them. The government really didn't care, didn't have any supports. And Lindy Jacom, who is a former member of the Exclusive Brethren, now called the Plymouth Brethren Christian Church. And she has set up the Olive Leaf Network, which is an organization for people leaving high control groups. And we run this podcast called Cult Chat. And the aim of the podcast is to increase awareness across the New Zealand social, education, mental health, primary care, public service, government landscape to kind of change thinking, basically. We've got a pretty grand goal, but we're deeply invested. And I think the three of us, with our different hats on, different personal experiences, have the right to shout loudly. And so far, so good. People are listening, actually. So I particularly care about the primary care frontline healthcare moment when people see a doctor, because often when you're in a high demand group, that's one of the only kind of outside people you get to see. And there are a bunch of doctors who saw me as a kid who didn't make much of a difference. Wish they had made more of a difference. And education's another point of contact often, though often these groups have their own schools, so that doesn't necessarily give that option. So we have this podcast that's being played on Plains FM, which is a community access radio station here in Canterbury, and it's been shared with other community access radio stations across New Zealand. So last count, I think there's about 12 different radio stations that have picked us up.
Yay.
Quite exciting. And we have a fortnightly drop, though we've got so much to say, we keep on finding extra things to pop in there because there's always stuff happening. You know, there's always something crazy going on in the cultosphere. Yeah, it's exciting. It's fun.
And I think that's the power of sharing these stories. Like I did that with my podcast, Coin the Con, and it was therapy in a podcast format, which I never thought it was, and sometimes very painful and uncomfortable as you sit with telling these stories. But then you realize the other side of it is that if somebody's listening, just one person listens and it makes a difference. It's worth it.
Yeah, well, we've had some good feedback. You've reminded me that whole vulnerability thing that when you do this, the terror of putting yourself out there. And I think, like I was saying earlier, just, you know, with my kind of hovering over the press return button on the keyboard, you fear what's going to happen and you make it far, far bigger than it ever is. But then you exceed. And that there's an adrenaline kick in that, you know, like, oh my God, I surmounted this hurdle that I was terrified over. And I'm never going back to that point again. I'm never going to think that I couldn't get over that hurdle. Where's the next hurdle? You know, and it's got to be bigger than that last one. So I think that courage calls to courage, and anxiety is infectious. It's contagious. You know, you're around an anxious person, you contaminate them with your anxiety. But bravery is also infectious. When you're around someone who's passionate and driven and excited and has vision, you can't help but capture it. And that is why cults happen, of course, because the people with the vision are toxic narcissists who just want to rip you to shreds. But when you find some people who want to grow a vision that can change things.
Authentic.
Yeah. I mean, that's a whole extra podcast. In fact, it's probably an episode on my show. How can you tell when someone's healthy and someone's not, you know, like.
Well, actually, I think it's quite interesting. And when you look at that from the social media, well, people that are out there touting so many different things, it's like, how do people believe and trust in what somebody is saying is right? That's one that I'd like to know is we have these layers of people manipulating and psychopathy in everyday life. And I think it's around us being able to go, that's actually not okay. What's happening there. So the education around that's really powerful.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like, you don't learn just about cults when you unpack this stuff. A cult's the most extreme and dangerous version of a continuum of influence, which is from like a harmful, dangerous, destructive influence to positive, uplifting, change-making influence. Yeah. I mean, Kate Shepard, she was a massive influencer that changed the world. You know, like, influence is a neutral thing. It's how it is used and what the motivation is and whether it leads to freedom or control that shapes whether or not this is a thing that should be followed or not. And I think particularly in this sort of recent age of misinformation, there's a real ignorance around who should we believe and who should we go, not all opinions are equal. Thank you very much.
I've loved our conversation. I could speak to you for hours, but I also know that there are some real gems in this episode around sharing your story, finding your voice, finding the courage to do it, and knowing that by doing that again and taking those steps forward, there is a ripple effect of that challenge response. And that we have a responsibility in our medical professions and our health professions to create safety. That's the other parts that I've really taken away from today. And if anybody wants to learn more about the podcast, check out Cult Chats on Spotify and Apple. Yep.
Every other platform. And the Plains website, Plains FM website.
Can I ask you what you think bravery is?
I like courage better. Bravery was a word that got thrown around so much after I was on the TVNZ documentary. It was like people couldn't think of another word, but yeah. I like courage.
Courage.
Thank you.
What is courage for you?
Courage for me involves having insight. You have to understand what you're afraid of before you can chase courage. It's saying what needs to be said in the moment, even though you're terrified. Courage and integrity are intimately interlinked for me, because probably it was my integrity, my determination to live by my values, that forced me to be brave. In the end, I have to stop being quiet.
Thank you for tuning into the Bravery Academy. Don't forget to hit that subscribe button. And if you're looking to take your support for the podcast to the next level, visit patreon.com/thebraveryacademy to access exclusive content and get early access to our upcoming episodes. Your feedback means the world to us. So please take a moment to give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. Thank you for being part of the Bravery Academy community. Stay brave, stay curious, and keep challenging yourself to grow. Until next time.